Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 16th of January 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Had to think about that briefly. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And it's a good day.
Yes, it is. Yes.
The wheels are coming off.
They are indeed. But we're going to start off with the fashion victim herself. Theresa May is going to feature in Vogue US spread, and she's going to become the first Prime Minister to do so, according to The Independent. I have to say this perhaps says more about her own image of herself than any kind of reality.
Yep.
So question is, will she be wearing any £1,000 leather trousers?
Well, she's apparently quite keen on leather trousers. It's very interesting how she sort of remodeled herself, isn't she? Because you've got the occasional splash of Theresa May wearing some sort of smart clothes, but then you'd see her and she was looking pretty lackluster. Now she's Prime Minister and all of a sudden it's Vogue and leather trousers. And is that her main interest? Is she, I don't know.
Narcissism?
Is she after a toy boy, maybe?
Perhaps. Anyway, let's move quickly on to more serious subjects. Sorry, excuse me, Bahrain. And over the weekend, we had the executions of three men found guilty of killing three policemen. This has caused riots, other civil unrest. And I believe there've been arson attacks and so on. But we need to go to our illustrious Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, for the UK's position on this. The UK is firmly opposed to the death penalty. And it is our long-standing position to oppose capital sentences in all circumstances, is what Boris Johnson said. The Bahraini authorities are fully aware of our position, and I've raised the issue with the Bahraini government. So that's all a bit ironic, bearing in mind, as we reported last week, Jeremy Wright, the Attorney General, said, "But where the evidence supports an assessment that an attack is imminent, it cannot be right that a state is prevented from meeting its first duty of protecting its citizens." And of course, that was with reference to extrajudicial killings of citizens of the United Kingdom by the United Kingdom government using drone strikes. So not quite sure how those two positions marry.
I don't think they do, Mike. But of course, it's not just killing UK citizens. It's anybody else who happens to get in the way of the drone strike, isn't it? So,
well, absolutely.
The UK government is simply saying, and it isn't the government, because this is never debated inside Westminster, who are we going to kill? This is always done behind closed doors with a cabal of who? The Prime Minister, Intelligence Services, Privy Council. It's an unknown group of people deciding we're going to launch a drone strike to kill an individual with no evidence brought forward or trial.
So it's not so much a case of four legs good, two legs better. It's a case of, judicial executions good, extrajudicial executions better.
Yeah, and the more brutal the regime, the better friend of UK they are.
Absolutely. Saudi, for example. Right. Anyway, today is the EU Foreign Affairs meeting. And this was Boris as he arrived for his doorstep interview. For the EU Foreign Affairs Ministers meeting. There we go. He looks very smart.
He's looking a little bit shaky, actually, I think. A little bit worse for wear.
Perhaps.
Did he have a hard night on the tiles, as they say? Was it drinking? Was it, I don't know, Coke, possibly?
Perhaps he should be up for a spread in Vogue. I don't know. But anyway, the council is going to be chaired by Federica Mogherini, of course. Meeting started at 9:30 this morning, and they're going to be concentrating on Syria. So they're going to be looking at developments in Syria following the ceasefire. They're going to discuss the EU's role in supporting the ceasefire and a genuine political transition in Syria. So regime change absolutely still on the agenda as far as the EU are concerned. The Middle East peace process over lunch, they are discussing that. And this is following the adoption of Security Council Resolution 2334 and also the Paris conference, which took place yesterday. Ministers are discussing the way forward to achieve a comprehensive peace deal, preserve the viability of its two-state solution and reverse ongoing negative trends on the ground, is how they're describing it. And the third major agenda item apparently is Lebanon. And the council is going to adopt, without any kind of debate, conclusions on Lebanon's presidential elections and the formation of a new government. So they don't need to discuss that. They're just going to rubber stamp it. So there you go. No discussion needed.
It's really interesting. This is happening at the present time. We're going to come on a little bit later in the news to have a look at what the BBC is doing to help that European Union foreign policy. And I think some of our viewers and listeners today are going to be pretty staggered at what is in front of our eyes once we know where to look for it.
So, as we said, yesterday was the Paris meeting over the Palestine-Israel situation. And, of course, neither representatives from Palestine nor representatives from Israel were there. So this was the cabal of people that were deciding the future of those countries. Not that they're our countries just yet, but they're aiming for a two-state solution, they say. We're here to reiterate strongly that the two-state solution is the only one possible, said the French foreign minister, so that's good. I think Netanyahu's too busy fending off corruption allegations to turn up for that. And so they went ahead and had it anyway. I'm sure that's going to be a particularly useful meeting.
And that's what, one or possibly two token women there?
Yes.
Amongst those suited individuals.
And the token Secretary of State, of course, because he's out of a job in a couple of days' time. So moving on, what one thing not mentioned at either of those meetings, of course, is Ukraine. But Poroshenko is hoping that Donald Trump is going to maintain a focus on Ukraine and keep the pressure on Russia. So that's all good. We count on a succession in our common work on the part of the new U.S. administration. Said Poroshenko, we're ready for effective and fruitful cooperation with the new administration. So that's good. But the new administration, when it comes in, is not quite sure exactly where they stand on global affairs, because NATO is obsolete, according to Donald Trump. This is very interesting language. And I do wonder half the time whether he's just making fun of people.
I'm going to say on this one, Mike, I don't think so, because I remember quite a bit around that statement where when he made it, and it was very forceful because he backed it up by saying, well, one of the key problems was that it was the US that was essentially paying for the thing and other people weren't paying their way. This helped to push the supposed increase of 2% by UK into this. So I think he was very serious at the time. But we can't discuss it on today's news. There's some remarkable stuff going on, because at the moment the Americans have sort of withdrawn all their carriers. So they've got their carriers lined up in one place, their aircraft carriers. Strategic madness on the basis that one small nuclear weapon would deal with a lot of them. Nobody has ever seen anything like this before. A strange decision made by Obama.
But Pearl Harbor comes to mind.
So we've got the ramping up, this rhetoric that those nasty Russians are about to invade us. And what does the US do? It pulls its carriers back. What does David Cameron do as former prime minister? Well, he simply takes out the Nimrod aircraft, which are a key part of the defence of our nuclear deterrent. So there's some very strange stuff going on here, if you look at it against the backdrop of the so-called threat from Russia.
Well, Jens Stoltenberg from NATO said he was concerned.
Good.
Yes. Okay, let's move on. What else was Donald Trump doing? Well, he was tweeting out that intelligence agencies should never have allowed this fake news to leak into the public. This was the whole Russian business. One last shot at me. Are we living in Nazi Germany? Well, pretty strong language from Mr. Trump. And, outgoing head of the CIA wasn't too impressed with that. He doesn't want to see any more careless tweets.
Sure he doesn't.
He was pretty upset. But let's see, what else was Donald Trump saying? He was suggesting the EU is going to break up, sooner the better. He was looking forward to a trade deal with the UK. He said that Angela Merkel had made a big mistake with immigration. And he said that he wants an arms control deal with Russia. And in fact, if there was to be an arms control deal with Russia, particularly over nuclear non-proliferation, that he's quite certain there would be no further sanctions on Russia. That's another way of saying that he's no intention of putting any more sanctions on Russia. That he believes he can probably do do a deal with them.
That's a very interesting statement. Somebody in our chat box has just said, well, basically it's the Americans pulling Europe towards war. But let's take a little look at the BBC and see if we can have a think about who is the actual hand driving the policy. Maybe it is not as simple as just one country. We need to have a look about, of course, the international banking cartel and the power being wielded from the City of London. But let's do a little recap to our report on Friday. We chose The Guardian. What was The Guardian saying? The BBC is setting up a team to debunk fake news. This was going to be called the Reality Check Team, and they're going to focus on content that's clearly fabricated and attempting to mislead the public into thinking it's been produced by a reputable news organisation. And then they go on and say, well, a lot of this, we've got to do it because of the disastrous happenings around the Brexit vote and the US elections, to which we say yes, because you're worried that the public actually made up their own mind to leave the EU and the American public decided to vote in Trump. But this was the man leading it, James Harding. He was the gentleman who had to apologise to Leveson as the editor at the time, the editor of the Times, because his journalists had been hacking. But he says the BBC can't edit the internet, but we won't stand aside either. We'll fact check the most popular outliers on Facebook, Instagram and other social media. We're working with Facebook in particular. See how we meet. We're where we see deliberately misleading stories masquerading as news. We'll publish a reality check that says so. So let's have a think about how the BBC itself goes about producing news. Well, we have encouraged people time and again to look at the BBC's charity. It says it's independent of the BBC, but it's absolutely not. It shares office facilities. It shares pension pots. It shares a whole lot more. But here's Media Action. What are they doing? Well, they're creating programs in Syria. So what are we doing here? Well, here they're talking about the fact that Syria is in a prolonged conflict, and they're basically producing radio and drama programs to talk to the Syrian people. Here's another one, and fostering a sense of national identity in Syria through drama. So really, the subliminal message here is you don't have a national identity, but you need us, the BBC, to help you put that identity together.
Now, this drama is in the form of what, soap opera?
Some of it's soap opera. Some of it is actually supposedly training up journalists in the area to put out their own media. But of course, they're trained by the BBC. The money comes in through the BBC and from other sources, as we're going to see. And then who do they hold their allegiance to? Syria or the BBC? Who's helping to get them paid? Mm. I think that's a pretty easy one. But of course, if we remember Vanessa Bealey in her reports from Syria and about Syria, she said one of the biggest strengths of Syria is that it has a very strong and inclusive national identity. So the reports from the front by Vanessa show the power of the national identity. It's very strong. But in the background, we've got BBC Media Action supposedly helping those weak, poor Syrians to develop their own national identity. Well, let's remember this lady, Julia Harkin. She was a former project manager for BBC Media Action. And she spilt the beans. We, BBC Media Action, worked in 2004 with individuals within the Syrian ministry who wanted change and tried to get them to be drivers of that. All media development work that has been done in Syria has, in my opinion, been predicated upon the idea that there can be change from within. You have an authoritarian regime and you find who the reformers are within that and you work with them. So this woman is clearly describing subversion. The BBC, via the cover of a charity, BBC Media Action, getting into Syria to help push regime change. And
well, what that demonstrates is that the Syrian war effectively began in 2004 with the actions of the BBC.
This is absolutely right, Mike. And of course, We've previously encouraged people to go and read this article where we were actually talking about BBC doing the same thing in other parts of the world. Kazakhstan mentioned here, but Ukraine is also on it. Get in, get amongst local people, say that you're there to train journalists, to get out drama, to get out media, social media. And what are you actually doing? You're starting to stir the pot. You're raising issues which you know are going to divide people. You're going to raise controversial. You're going to raise women's rights against what laws are in the country. So this is the BBC. But you've just spelt out that we've got the EU meeting for policy over Syria. Am I right in saying that the EU's policy over Syria has been that there needs to be regime change?
And it still is.
It still is. So the EU, the UK, the US all say we want regime change in Syria. There can only be a future if Assad moves aside. And of course, what have we seen? Plans to divide Syria. So let's follow on through some of this material because it just gets more and more interesting. We've got another media action program going on here. Just encourage people to go to their site and you will find this stuff yourself. And who's been funding this one? Well, here we are, EU Humanitarian Aid and the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, the US Department of State. Now, is the EU, is the US Department of State going to fund individuals who are not helping their foreign policy?
No.
I don't think so.
But just to clarify that, that's the EU Humanitarian Aid and Civil Protection and the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration for the US Department of State. So that's the EU and the US putting money into BBC media action for subversion in a foreign country.
Correct. And if we stick with the EU side, you will find it links back to this, the European Union External Action. And it says that this is the European Union's diplomatic service. It helps the EU's foreign affairs chief, the High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, carry out the Union's common foreign security policy. So there are the words, helps carry out the Union's common foreign and security policy. So anybody taking the money is going to be helping to push forward European policy and security policy. And we know that that policy is for regime change in Syria. So if we just bring in another aspect to this one, if you go onto the website on the right here, you can quickly find EU funded projects for Syria. There's a whole lot of them listed. They give you information on it. But we decided to just have a few here. So we've got Bridging Syria's Divides, mass media programming and platforms to build resilience and social cohesion to counter violent conflict. I think they're doing the opposite, Mike. We've got Supporting Transition Towards Democracy in Syria through preparing for an engendered constitution building process.
Those two items are exclusive. You can't have them both.
Well, if we believe they're doing what they say,
right.
But if you say they're doing the opposite, actually, it works extremely well.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom, we've got strengthening social cohesion for a diplomatic and inclusive Syrian civil society. So this is future policy. And what they're actually doing is saying, well, we're working towards what Syria is going to be after Assad has gone. Mm. So here's this one, the big one, which we spotted, Bridging Syria's Divides, mass media programming and platforms to build resilience and social cohesion. Well, who was putting that together? Well, none other than BBC Media Action, getting a mere 2.4 million euros to carry out EU foreign policy. So this is the BBC not only manufacturing its own news, it's actually manufacturing the war that it wants to report in order to push forward European foreign policy. And we'll put this one on screen for our very own David Ellis, who, of course, has been warning and warning about the creation of the EU military on the lie of Brexit. On that same website, European Union External Action, we've got third media tour by the BBC BBC busy going on board the Italian aircraft carrier during its programme for EU NAV4. So this is the BBC helping to promote the idea and cohesiveness of an EU military. That's silent, it. Yes. We're about to be silent there. But don't worry, because the BBC is going to be checking UK column, and it's going to be checking other alternative media sites to see whether we're telling any naughty little lies. Stay posted on the BBC, because there's a lot more to come out. What the BBC isn't reporting, of course, is anything to do with child abuse. And we were shocked last week when we learnt that Melanie Shaw had been given 2 years. This is actually the maximum sentence, I'm now told, for this breach of the restraining order.
So we now know what the problem was.
Yeah, it was breach of a restraining order, but they don't appear to have taken the time served into account in this sentence. So is she going to be out after 50% of the sentence? She spent 9 months in, another 3 months. Or is Melanie going to be in for 2 years and 9 months? We don't know. But I believe Robert Green's been speaking out on this.
Well, not yet. He will be live tonight on Freedom Talk Radio Scotland. If you Google Freedom Talk Radio Scotland, you get the link to this. It's hosted by Blog Talk Radio, and that's on this evening at 7 o'clock, I believe. And Robert Green will be discussing Melanie. Yeah. So anybody wants to listen to that, it's head over to Blog Talk Radio and search for Freedom Talk Radio Scotland.
Yeah, excellent. Now, just the reminder that Melanie's also facing these charges on the 25th of February, alleged assault against HMP Fostenhall prison staff. So Melanie's in the insidious position at the moment. She's in a prison that's already brutalised her. She's already been extremely frightened. She's still with those staff. Now those staff are able to bring assault charges against her, but they're still the people looking after Melanie. Well, we'd like to say a very big thank you to the person who said we need to have a look at the HMP Inspectorate of Prisons. And we did that, and we looked at the recent survey that they'd undertaken. This is from the end of last year, where they'd taken a look into HMP Fostenhall. It says there were fewer late arrivals at the prison than previously. Some important aspects of support during women's early days required improvement. In our survey, many women reported feeling unsafe and victimised, although most issues were not serious and involved verbal bullying. 4 self-inflicted deaths had occurred since the last inspection, but an action plan has been developed and was being implemented. Care for those at risk at self-harm was generally sound, and some good work was undertaken to manage those with complex needs. Now, we spoke to the prison inspectorate this morning. The lady who answered the phone was very reasonable, but where we quickly came to is that the inspectorate says, well, we can't actually do anything on a day-to-day basis to help prisoners in prison, even though we're pointing out that, of course, the treatment of Melanie falls well within the categories of concern for the inspectorate in the first place.
So they go and they inspect a prison from time to time, and in the meantime, nothing happens.
That's about the
height of it.
Long and short of it. So add in this piece as well. So this was another part of the summary here, S5. It says, in our survey, over half of women said they felt unsafe in the prison at some time, and 46% said they'd been victimised by other prisoners, more than comparators. Investigations into antisocial behaviour took place promptly, and information was shared. The early intervention system provided a nuanced response to minor bullying. So 46% of the women said they felt, well, no, it says over half of the women said they felt unsafe. So more than 50% say they feel unsafe in this prison. We've got Melanie Shaw talking about men coming into her cell and utterly terrifying her. She's held under solitary confinement. She's stripped in front of other prisoners. But HMP Inspectorate of Prisons says, well, if you tell us, we can have a look at it, but we don't actually have the power to do anything about this. Have you spoken to the police? Yes. Have you spoken to NHS England for problems with treatment? Yes. Didn't they do anything? No. And then it goes silent. Mm. So we're going to make some further recommendations because the inspectorate say they are interested in receiving information about Melanie's case. Of course, it's got to be properly assembled. It's got to be reasonable. It's got to be evidence-based. And we're going to look to do that. But we will just add in this bit as well, because this is a little bit more about the document. It says this: all inspections carried out by HM Inspectorate of Prisons contribute to UK's response to its international obligations under the optional protocol to the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment and Punishment. What this is really saying is that the UN condemns solitary confinement as torture, and Melanie Shaw has now spent 9 months in solitary confinement. So it'll be interesting to see what HM Inspectorate of Prisons has to say when they have the information. And of course, we'd really like people to write and even send your mail for Melanie to Chris Leslie. This is a local MP. He loved the photographs when she was well and working for him, but he has simply ditched her when she's been brutalised for whistleblowing on child abuse matters. We looked at those executions in Bahrain, Mike, but when we get under the surface of what's going on in UK, women suicided in that prison, prisoners locked up, solitary confinement, no justice. Theresa May busy playing with her leather trousers for a Vogue photo shoot. We are in an appalling state.
Absolutely. Well, here's somebody else who's in an appalling state. That's Chris Bryant. And back on the agenda is that we've got to close the Houses of Parliament because it's an urgent need of multi-billion pound repairs to avoid being flooded with sewage. Chris Bryant said it was ironic that one of the catastrophic failures that risked endangering the building could come from sewage flood from the Victorian draining system. He said the main one which we've suffered historically is fire. Some kind of water flood, either cascading down or cascading up through from the drains, is another possibility. The sewage system of this building lies at a lower level than the city drain, as it were, and so all the drainage from every single toilet and kitchen and so on in the palace goes down in one big drain to the far end underneath the Speaker's garden, where it goes into a slightly beautiful contraption that was put in the 1880s and then is effectively spat into the main drain. Now, if that were to break down, and it's 130 years old now, that would close the building. Now, many people would say that's possibly not a bad thing, and certainly with people with minds like Chris Bryant's, then perhaps it's not a bad thing. But nonetheless, it is what we've got at the moment, and we should be standing up for our constitution and not letting these subverters and traitors destroy it.
This is a scam to close Parliament.
Absolutely.
Mike, isn't it? Billions of pounds of repair work to a build. This just does not add up. It simply does not add up. This is the excuse to move our politicians out of Westminster so that we are achieving the EU directive of London as a separate nation state, I think is the right word. So this is a scam. If anybody's got any documentary evidence of these dilapidations of what the problems are with the building and what the associated costs are in detail, we'd certainly like to see them. But I think what we're looking at here is fake news from the Independent, because there is no justifiable basis for this £1 billion, multi-billion pound expenditure. We'll see what comes back. So should we close Parliament? Well, on the basis is a cesspit. Of course, there is a little bit of a statement to do just that. I've pulled out this. It's an old article from The Guardian, MPs in corruption shocker. There's a list of all sorts of MPs that have been accused of offences. But the article by Philip Cowley here is protecting them because he says that this email and the statistics in it are complete fabrication. It was created on a website called Capitol Hill Blue. It was to do with the US House and Senate. It's simply not true. And if we were concerned about accuracy, most of the figures about criminal activity, that is, would read zero. So this is simply not true. Now, I noticed that back in this article, they did mention India. So I thought it was highly appropriate that we picked up on the BBC article this morning, which is asking, why do Indians vote for criminal politicians? So this article, if you really analyse it, is an advert for a book called When Crime Pays. But the BBC is selling it to the licence fee payer as news. The good news is that the general election in India is thriving. 454 million voters queued up at 900,000 stations to cast their ballots. And then it goes on to say the bad news is that a third of the 543 MPs who were elected faced criminal charges, which is up 30%. It's interesting that the Indians actually bother to work out what their politicians are up to, Mike.
Well, yeah, but as well as that, what's the population of India? And they've got 543 MPs, and we've got 650.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Because ours simply talk, they don't do anything.
Right.
So we'll add this last bit. Some of the charges were minor nature or politically motivated, but more than 20% of the new MPs face serious charges, such as attempted murder, assaulting public officials, and theft. So the BBC can report on the state of politicians in India. But where are we? They're not so good about reporting UK politicians. This is the book. The gentleman believes that well-informed voters support criminal candidates in constituencies where social divisions driven by caste and or religion are sharp and the government is failing to carry out its functions. So I think what he's saying is when people get really frustrated that things aren't right, they'll actually vote for whoever says the right things, whether they're a criminal or not.
Right.
Okay, well, let's have a look when you start to ask, are there any criminals in Westminster? So this is a Freedom of Information request listed out on the parliamentary website. Could you tell me how many MPs in the United Kingdom we have? How many have criminal convictions? Of those, how many are fraud offences or sexual offences? So in 2014, this was the request for some detail. And this is the reply that came back. It's quite detailed. We've got 650 MPs, they say there. And then it says, offences, this information is not held by the House of Commons. On this occasion, we're unable to identify any other public authority from whom you may be able to request this information. So it's all gone very woolly here, Mike. We simply don't really know who would hold this information.
Well, of course, because a criminal conviction is not a guarantee that you lose your seat.
Absolutely right. Now, they do say, well, look, you should have a look at this paper, Members' Imprisonment Since 1979. So that looks exciting. You think you're going to come into something. Well, here's that document. In all cases in which members of either House are arrested on criminal charges, the House must be informed. But nobody holds any data on it.
Right.
But this is the report. Now, remember, the request was 2014, members' imprisonment since 1979, and this document itself is the 2008. So this is all pretty woolly.
Yeah.
Now, I've got some bad news for you because there is a spreadsheet, and here it is, and it's all those nasty unionists.
Really?
It is. And apparently they didn't want to. What didn't they want to do? They didn't want to pay. They didn't want to pay following, I think it's court charges, following getting involved in some fracas.
Basically, it was 12th of July marching.
Yeah. And right. So here are all those nasty criminals. According, there's nobody else.
No other
MPs.
No child abusers, no fraud, no...
No. So we can best show it like this. There's right. No criminal convictions. There's nothing to see. But we did a little bit of work. And, of course, The Guardian here itself was talking about Leon Britton. The Guardian was talking about Mr. Janner. The Guardian was talking about the Westminster Child Abuse Ring. Nothing happened, of course. The Guardian was talking about Tony Blair creating unlawful wars. The Guardian here was talking about Mr. Rifkin, who was accepting cash or favours in order to give information to Chinese companies. It was all a little gruesome. We've got good old Ken Clark, who was accused of sexual abuse. The person was taken to court but found not guilty, but nothing to see there. We've got Keith Vaz, drugs and rent boys, nothing to see there. Who else we got? Liam Fox. Well, he was with his young friend Werity, and apparently Mr. Werity was sort of passing himself off as security cleared when he wasn't. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're in Parliament. And of course, we've got the expenses fiddling, known as fraud. Here was the gentleman that spent £1,600 of public money on his duck pond, duck house. But this isn't criminal activity. It's also not criminal activity if you have metropolitan policemen warning that children were being groomed, abused, trafficked, pushed out for prostitution and murdered. And it's covered up by the Met Police, sorry, British politicians, local authorities, child protection services and child charities. That doesn't mean anything at all.
No.
And we know it doesn't mean anything because here's the Minister for Policing, Mr. Lewis, and he didn't want to reply to an open letter asking what he was going to do. So the Guardian newspaper hasn't investigated any of this, and the policing minister doesn't bother to reply. But I think we are able to say with some certainty, as truthful news, that there is absolutely no criminal activity connected with the British government at all.
Excellent. So we should trust them then?
We should trust them.
We should trust them. Well, that's good because today Edelman has put out its 2017 trust barometer. It does this every year. And Edelman, of course, PR company, is based on a survey. In this case, 33,000 responses from 28 countries between the 13th of October and the 16th of November last year. And that was 1,150 UK residents among that lot. And it carried out research with another 1,500 UK residents between the 23rd of December and the 7th of January. And what did they discover? Well, they discover that trust in the media fell precipitously and it's at all-time lows. In 17 countries. Trust in government dropped in 14 countries, it is the least trusted institution in half of the 28 countries surveyed. The credibility of leaders is in peril. Chief executive credibility dropped 12% globally to an all-time low of 37%. And so the Trust Barometer found that 53% of respondents believe the current overall system has failed them, that it's unfair, that it offers little hope for the future, and only 15% of people believe that it's working, and about a third of people aren't sure whether it's working or not. They say that even the elites have a lack of faith in the system, with 48% of the top quartile in income, 49% of the college educated, and the majority of the well-informed saying that the system has failed. Now, what's really interesting about this, of course, is that they're saying that the mass of the population of 20 countries distrusts their institutions, compared to only six countries for the informed public. So what they're saying is that if you're an informed person, Brian, you're much more likely to trust your institutions, you'll trust the government, you'll trust the media, if you're informed. So you get to trust the media by being informed by the media.
Well, this is what BBC's reality check is all about, of course, because they're not just going to check other people for the accuracy of their reporting. The BBC then says, and we want to report the truth in a more grabbing way. I thought they meant grubby, but it's grabbing. They're going to do it at a slower pace. Notice the movement of the hands. I've got the full issue going on here. And what are they going to do? Well, if you believe us, if you believe the BBC, then, of course, you're going to believe that your politicians are upstanding, truthful,
trustworthy
people. This is absolute madness, of course. And perhaps we should finish that by saying the madness has now got to this level, which is apparently there's a proposal to make a movie of the illustrious Mr. Blair's life. And it says he's in talks with the producer of biopics of Amy Winehouse. Well, very tragic death for Amy Winehouse. My goodness, Tony Blair's put himself in quite a league with Amy Winehouse.
Yes. Yes, right. Okay, well, what can you say?
Well, we can't. But I would like to apologise because I did mean to start today's programme with a welcome to the senior BBC News team who we understand are now watching UK Column on a daily basis. We're delighted to have BBC tuning in. I hope you'll make some exceptions for us because we operate on a budget a little under £3.65 billion. However, I think that we're doing particularly well at digging the truth out about what the BBC is really up to. Now, viewers and listeners think that I'm just being silly and sarcastic here. I'm absolutely not, because a BBC insider was very pleased to tell us that we're now being watched by the BBC.
Yeah.
That's excellent news. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. If you can get pen to paper or that email going, then get on to Chris Leslie. Let's start talking about Melanie Shaw. She's the one in solitary confinement at the moment. At the end of the day, as law and order and justice breaks down in UK, it could be any of us. It's up to all of us to stop it. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.